This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley has seen her city through devastating tornadoes, a mass shooting downtown, and now the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. What will the slow reopening of the economy mean in the city? Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley joins us now on the phone. Mayor Whaley, thank you so much for your time today.
It's good to be on. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Mayor. I want to start by just asking how you're doing during all of this.
Well, I think I'm doing just like everyone else. You know, this is a time of great uncertainty for myself and for everyone in our community. And you get up each day and control what you can control and try to think of what the future is like and prepare for how it may be different and the things that you would like for it to be the same and that you can control in that. So, I think I've been amazed, frankly, again, by the community I'm in Dayton. It's an amazing city of grit and resilience and real trust in each other. And so we've seen pretty decent control of the virus because people really do view them in it together. And that's been an honor to get to be a leader through.
You talk about your city's resilience, as I just noted, and we've talked to you about this before, getting your city through the severe weather that hammered it, the tragic mass shooting downtown. While the COVID-19 pandemic is universal, can you speak a little more to how your community specifically is getting through this situation after having gone through other devastating circumstances in recent times?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things that Dayton has shown is that, you know, working through disasters and crisis, we are crisis tested and disaster tested. And so the relationships we have in the community are very strong with each other because of what we've been through last year. And so it wasn't hard for us when this came on for us to be engaged with different partners, folks that, you know, not necessarily have the authority to speak to the mayor or to the city regularly, but those connections are just very, very strong. So I think that was helpful to us in this crisis. I will say, as I look back on all the issues that Dayton's had to face this past year, they are all national issues that have incredible local consequences, whether it be extreme weather, which is the causes of climate change, or which mayors across the country. For example, I feel for the city of Nashville, who had their tornadoes just weeks before the COVID pandemic hit our communities, or if it's, you know, not having common sense gun legislation. These are national issues that have not been answered nationally. And even in the COVID disaster, we see just a real inadequacy of the federal government doing anything to really stitch together a federal response to a national issue. And so you see it getting done on local and state levels again.
We talked with Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley yesterday on the program, and the city here is facing some financial uncertainty. It's budget time, crafting for the next fiscal year. What's happening at Dayton City Hall in terms of the financial situation?
Well, it's pretty painful right now. I think like most cities across the state of Ohio, because we are funded through income tax and not property tax like a lot of other cities across the country, we will feel the effects of the economic downturn of the pandemic first. And I know for Dayton, we're looking at around 18% cuts across our budgets for each department. And I know across the state, cities are anywhere from 15 to 25%. They are significant. And you also, I think the key part for Dayton is, you know, we went through a very hard Great Recession. Probably the city that had it just worse than Dayton would be Detroit. But Dayton was probably second in the country on job loss percentage and just the amount of cuts we had to do during 2009 and 2010. And during that period, the state continued to cut us as well. So, you know, if we have to go through this, there's not any fat on these budgets. It's going to be frontline responders, which have been heroic every day, but especially in our community, when you think of what we've been through and the heroic nature of these heroes on the front line. And, you know, we've been trying, I know Mayor Cranley's been, we've been working together, trying to get that message across to the federal government that we don't want to have to make these cuts. And it makes sense for the federal government to to invest in private sector, but it certainly makes them sense for them to invest in public sector, since these are the people that you count on day in, day out through a disaster. And so it will be very difficult and very painful should we not get any federal help.
And we're talking with Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley. Mayor, so are you talking about 18% cuts to police and fire as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's just no way around doing that sort of, if you have an 18% cut in our budget, 60% of our budget is police and fire. So there's just no way that you can't not affect police and fire in that process because it's such a big portion of what we do. I think in the federal, government, they, have these views of these fancy cities. And I make it really clear, Dayton is not fancy. You know, it's a city that, again, it has grit and resilience, but, we're doing frontline basic services that are required to have some sort of quality of life. And to cut that, particularly on the people that have just been so heroic, is bizarre that the federal government would allow that to happen.
And so the new fiscal year begins on July 1. When would you anticipate such cuts take place, right at that moment?
So we're different than Cincinnati. Cincinnati's July 1. We're actually January 1st.
Oh, so your calendar year.
Yeah. So what we are doing is, our budget's obviously much different now than it
okay.
was in December. And so we're in the process of making cuts to the sitting budget, and then we'll look into January. But the 18% cuts we would expect come into effect probably June or July.
So it would still probably take place this summer that you're cutting employees loose permanently?
Yep. Yes. If we don't get any federal help, yes.
Are the police and fire represented by unions?
Yes.
So are there negotiations taking place about this?
Negotiations happen next year for negotiations. We've had some conversations just in general. We haven't made any decisions, but it's very obvious because you don't have anywhere else to cut. So, when 60% of your budget is police and fire and you have a near 20% cut in funding, there's no way you cannot affect those frontline services. And that's very difficult. And so that's why we're, really calling on the federal government. And we've been so engaged in these CARES discussions. We're hopeful on the CARES 4 that we'll get some relief, because if we get some relief, then we can keep these services in place. Keep in mind, cities, three quarters, if not more, of our budget is personnel. So it's all about humans and the services that are provided to communities. There's just no way around it.
So if the federal government were to come through with what may be characterized as a bailout or at least some sort of funding, these cuts across the board, all the departments, including the frontline responders, it could potentially be avoided.
Absolutely, it would be avoided. Our interest is to protect police and fire and to protect the frontline services. And we believe, too, that, these revenue losses due to COVID can get covered on them. Like, the recovery will be much faster, and we'll see faster recovery to our income tax as well. So that they are completely avoidable, and they're an investment not only into public safety, but I think they're an investment into the economic recovery as well. You will not see a recovery happen as quickly from the COVID effort economically if you don't invest in local and state government. They're a big portion of the economy, and that will slow the economy overall if you don't have those services there for your private sector, frankly.
So how are your conversations going with federal representatives?
Pretty good. I mean, I think we started working on this. I'm second vice president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and we started a month ago, with a $250 billion ask. Actually, that's where the CARES money came for the 32 largest cities. If you're a population over 500,000, that was, I think, a lot of the work that the conference did that got that in. The last round, we were shut out. It's getting a bit partisan, which makes us concerned because, we're talking about small towns that have Republican mayors, two big cities. This is, not something that is only for larger cities. And so we're hoping that message resonates. I've had good conversations, though, with Republicans in Ohio, congresspeople that are Republicans in Ohio, understanding the need for help for state and local. So I'm hopeful that that gets through, and we'll just keep working on it because it's just so critically important for the future of our communities.
And Mayor, when you say that the ask from cities was about $250 billion, mm-hmm. do you have an idea of what the amount might be for Dayton to keep it in a solid position?
No, I don't have like the amount, like how the Conference of Mayors would say, and this is how we should cut it up. And it was NACO, National League of Cities, and U.S. Conference of Mayors. I'll tell you, if we have a 20% cut to our budget's about $200 million, about forty million. That's a problem. Yeah.
So when you hear remarks
for half the year, it's about half the year, so it's really about $20 million. So then the recovery is key. So.
What were your thoughts on the remarks by Senator Mitch McConnell that basically said he favors states filing for bankruptcy rather than bailing them out?
I mean, I think he's just being very partisan in his answer. I mean, it's clear that he wants to do that because he wants to have control of blue states like New York and California, where his donors are, so he can control the policy through a conservative federal judge. It's an incredibly partisan answer. And it's not good for the economy. And so I think, you know, if Republicans and Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump want to get this economy going quickly, which, you know, they say they do, certainly bankruptcy isn't the way to go. If you look at unlike states, cities can go bankrupt and have gone bankrupt. And if you look at cities that have, I'll give an example of Pittsburgh, and the mayor of Pittsburgh was on a House Ways and Means meeting last week and said it way more eloquently than me, but, you know, talked about when Pittsburgh went bankrupt 40 years ago and the decades it took for that city to come back. And that's just so unnecessary to put people through that pain when the federal government is interested in making sure private sector doesn't go bankrupt, but it's like, oh, I'm okay with public sector doing that when it has an effect that is ramifications way past just the government. Of that local community.
Mayor, parts of the economy are reopening and more parts of it will come online gradually. Do you believe that Dayton is ready for this? Is this the right time?
I think we still have some more work to do in Dayton and across the state, particularly around testing. I'm heartened by the governor's move about 2 weeks ago around increasing testing, but it's not stood up yet. And so we need to make sure that we have that testing and contact tracing in place, because the last thing we want to do, I think we've done amazing work. The governor has been terrific in being like the early call to what is happening, with COVID. And we don't want to lose all that good work just because we're anxious to eat a meal outside. I think people have sacrificed a lot and we don't want to just throw that away just because we're getting impatient in spring.
We've heard some mixed signals on masks, even from the governor in recent days. What are your thoughts on wearing masks in public places as part of the reopening process?
I think everyone should wear a mask in public enclosed spaces. I think if you're on the bike trail, it's hard to ride a bike with a mask on and you're not near folks. It's outside. Although Mayor Cranley told me he did do that. I think that's pretty impressive. inside enclosed places and retail where people are being forced to work through this time, I think it's really important that citizens wear masks out of respect to that. I was disappointed when the governor backed off on that. I understand that people have, Ohio has diverse views around collective versus the individual, but I think in general it just saddens me that folks aren't willing to do that for their fellow man, because really that's what we're trying to do when we have a mask. It's to protect others around you, not necessarily to protect yourself, because we don't know how many people have this that are asymptomatic. And that our communities and people in our communities aren't willing to do that, I think is sad. And I also wonder how folks that are living today would have ever survived standing up and comparing to the greatest generation in World War II and the sacrifices they've had to make. I mean, we're not asking for very much, and that folks are upset about their individual liberty about this for the collective of our country. I just find it unpatriotic, frankly.
Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley, thank you so much for your time. We hope to check in again soon.
Thank you. Thanks for all you do, and stay safe.
Same to you. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Opening the state's economies now, as the COVID-19 pandemic goes on, could be a mistake, according to Dr. Erwin Redlener. He's a pediatrician and the director of the Columbia University National Center for Disaster Preparedness, and he's on Skype with us now. Dr. Redlener, thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to be with you.
I'm glad to have you. And I just want to start with, here we go. We're reopening now parts of the economy at different stages across the country, at different levels in different states. What are you concerned about?
Well, first of all, I want to say in the beginning of this conversation that I am a very big believer in opening the economy as soon as we can and as soon as we can do it safely. And that last part of what I just said is the key here. If it was up to me and we had the testing and we could do it quickly, I would just tomorrow open everything. But if we do open prematurely, we're going to be in some serious trouble because there's many parts of the country that have not really even leveled off yet in terms of the number of cases they're getting and fatalities and so on. And even if you're in a community that has not yet reached this peak or is not even experiencing a surge, it's very almost inevitable that you will be. So when we talk about reopening the economy of, you know, I guess Georgia started first with the governor declaring that parts of the economy be reopened. I know there are other 30 other states, including Ohio, that have it, getting ready to kind of reopen. So here's the issue. So first of all, this is not like the macro economy we're talking about. I know there's issues with the stock market. It's been like a roller coaster ride, and the gross domestic product, unemployment issues. They're all major macroeconomic concerns that we're going to have to be riding the wave with. But what we're talking about now in terms of reopening the economy is a city like Dayton or Columbus, where you are talking about people in neighborhoods going into the barbershop, the hair salon, the local restaurant that you really like going to. Your car lease is up and you got to go car shopping. You know, there's a lot of things that we do locally as individuals and as families. And that's where my problem is. Let's say you wanted to get a haircut, which I desperately need right now myself. my wife won't let me go to see Renat, my barber, going to for a decade. And the reason is I have no idea whether Renat has COVID or not. And he has no idea whether I do. So without having him be tested on a very regular basis, and without me maybe being tested, but at least answering a questionnaire every time I walk into the barbershop that asks me about fever, other symptoms which could be related, have I traveled any place that might be of concern, unless I can document my own lack of having the coronavirus here, I'm a danger to other people in that shop, excuse me, including Renat, who's got a bunch of customers. He's dealing with one after another. So I think the problem is the reopening, when it's translated to your community, your neighborhood, is a whole different question or discussion than the big idea of are we able to, how many tests are we doing a day, for instance, which are the big national questions. But the local questions are what come to the fore when the governor says we're ready to start opening. And really, you should just put yourself in the personal and your listeners, just kind of like you want to go to your favorite restaurant, which has been closed now for a while, but you can't wait to get back there and take your kids and spouse and all that. And you go in there. Don't you want to know if the kitchen staff, the servers, the maitre d' have, in fact, been tested and are negative? Now, can we test everybody every day? No. Okay. If you get tested and you're negative on, Tuesday, will you still be negative on Wednesday? Probably you know, you're probably not going to be positive in a day, but you could be if you're in a high volume business. So what to do? So the problem right now, or the challenge, is we do not have the capacity to do the kind of testing that would be really necessary if we want to open businesses safely. And that's where things are.
And that's what I want to ask you, Dr. Redliner, is what would be a safe testing capacity in your estimation?
So technologically, we have the capability of building, you know, of producing very accurate, small, what's called point of care testers. And President Trump famously showed off one from Abbott Labs, about the size of a kitchen toaster. And theoretically, you could get the results in a few minutes. So I want to go back to my barber. And I wouldn't mind him doing a daily test to see if he's positive or not. That would be reassuring to me. There's no reason why we can't do that. We don't have the technology, and we don't know exactly how we'd pay for it. But we're dealing with a very serious biological threat in this pandemic. And I think this is something that should have been developed a long time ago. And is a a very rapid, readily available test that could be basically everywhere. That would be reassuring to me, and I think that would be necessary before we reopen.
You're the director of the Columbia University National Center for Disaster Preparedness. There are all kinds of disasters. And
correct.
Notwithstanding your hair, apparently, I do hope that you can get that taken care of at some point. But how do we prepare for this type of disaster? Is there something that folks in your line of work who are experts in this area can turn to for signs, clues, and evidence to deploy this time around?
Well, this is that's a really important question. So the last time we had really had to face anything like this was, before the living memory of almost every American, which was in 1918 when we had the so-called Spanish flu, which killed almost 700,000 Americans and maybe 50 million people worldwide. And we've known for a long time that we could get an eruption of a very serious, highly contagious disease. Remember, we had the SARS epidemic in 2003. We had swine flu in 2009 and other things in between that were defined as pandemics because they were caused by new viruses that were highly infectious, could kill people, and then would be transported across international borders. That's the definition of a pandemic. And there have been quite a lot of planning on the federal and state level for exactly what we're dealing with right now. In fact, between 2006 and 2009 or so, I was involved, as many other people were, in the federal plans for what we do with a major pandemic. And then virtually every state and every large city in the country had their own versions of the pandemic plan, of course, hoping that we would never use it. But here we go. And in fact, in the last couple of years during the Trump administration, there have been several federal exercises and plans, but none of them got implemented. So we were caught very, very short when it comes to obviously things like testing, and which we completely messed up. But even things like having our hospitals be ready for major onslaughts of a pandemic like this, very little was done, even though the plans were made.
I think a lot of us have learned a lot about the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, and for reasons that we wish we didn't have to. I live on the Kentucky side of the Cincinnati area, and the governor in Kentucky every day during his briefing references a couple of charts that compare Philadelphia and St. Louis's different responses in 1918 to show the way that their curve rose or went down quickly. And Philadelphia is usually characterized as a bad guy in that because they started to reopen. They had that notorious parade celebrating the end of the war at the time. And then their cases spiked. We also see cases out of San Francisco in 1918 of a similar nature. Is that something that we could be headed for?
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, in 1918, there was really no national policy. So that's why we had this sort of natural experiment where we saw the results in St. Louis versus in Philadelphia. It's one of the long-term problems. I just want to divert for a second, is that we have many disasters, all kinds of, you know, it's coastal storms. And we had, in 2017 alone, we had Hurricane Michael in Florida, Harvey in Texas, Maria in Puerto Rico in the region. We are, what we do is after every major disaster, we have all kinds of postmortems or after action reports. They list what happened. They talk about lessons that we've learned from disaster A, getting ready for disaster B. But the problem is we don't apply those lessons. I don't know what it is. It's just, you know, if we learn something from, you know, let's say Hurricane Harvey or Maria, how are we incorporating those lessons into planning for the next big hurricane? We just don't do that very well. As I said, it would take a longer conversation to try to talk that through. You yourself would probably have some good ideas about why that is. It has to do with human nature and the American way of doing things. But anyway, we don't do a good job of it.
I would like to talk about the American way of doing things, because I'm wondering what's unique to this country. Is it just our fondness of what we call liberty? There may be different definitions of what that means in the context of today's politics, but, you know, asking Americans to stay somewhere where they don't want to stay and telling us that we can't do what we want to do, does that take on a different dynamic compared to other parts of the globe?
Well, certainly certain parts of the globe where, you know, in much more totalitarian states like China, for example, the government can get away with a lot more control of personal behaviors and policies that they need to implement. But I think what we experience here, it's not exclusive to America. And I think in Western Europe is the same thing. Although if you watch what happened in Italy, there was a phenomenal amount of compliance when they were really surging and a lot of people were dying and their hospital systems were overwhelmed. I think, you know, I have some Canadian colleagues who say that, you know, they believe, particularly this one person I speak to often, she believes that what's happening in Canada is a much more controlled situation, let's say, where, you know, leaders are trusted and people are cognizant of the dangers we face and trust them. When, you know, part of the problem here is that, you know, our president has been all over the map with misinformation, information that he gives out that's either nonsensical or it's contradicted by his, you know, his medical teams and all that. And that is really, I think, eroded a lot of America's confidence in our leadership generally. And the other thing that's happened is it has left every state to do their own thing in a way, as opposed to having strong national recommendations starting in March when this was declared a pandemic. Even if it has to change, which it does have to change as we get more information, we've never had a clear, you know, directive that comes from the federal government about a, you know, with a president that we all trust. That's not been the case here. And I think that's created this chaos of why 30 or 31 states wanted to reopen. They have different criteria for doing so. This is not something we need to be improvising on a state-by-state basis. The information is the information, and the most senior, respected, experienced public health and health officials should be advising governors and the president, and here's what it is. I remember when this is all first really erupting, and we had the mayor of Seattle saying that no more gatherings of 250 people or more in New York City. A couple of days later, said no more gatherings of 500 people or more, and other states were saying 100. There was no reason for that. That should have been Tony Fauci saying, guys, we need to control this. We should not be having gatherings of more than 100 people. Start thinking about closing your schools. And we didn't get any of that definitiveness, which was really a problem, and it set us back.
And we're talking with Dr. Erwin Redlener. He's a pediatrician and the director of the Columbia University National Center for Disaster Preparedness. We've got about a minute left, Dr. Redlener, and I want to ask, you know, it seems that every day we're learning new things about not just the state of things, but the situation. And so we read stories in reputable outlets about a possible new strain of this thing, or we learn about earlier cases discovered in some parts of the world. With all of this stuff changing and the limited testing available, is your estimation that we should be waiting before we open these doors?
Absolutely, yes. We should be waiting. It's the story of, are you going to take your family to the restaurant without any level of confidence that none of the people preparing or serving your food you're not going to know whether they're negative or positive. It's uncomfortable. Do we want people going to the salons and the barbershops and the, electronic shop or whatever it is that people want to be able to do again, including gathering? We just are not ready. We've tested less than 2% of the American population, and it's not enough. We don't know enough about the reliability of the antibody test, the so-called serology. We're way behind, and that's a whole other story. If you've got another couple hours, we'd love to talk to you about why we're so far behind. But we are, and I think we have to, as difficult as it is for all of us, to adapt to these requirements, and it's painful and difficult. We still have to think about being as safe as possible when we reopen.
And we're not seeing the cases decline at the rate necessary, in your estimation.
In some places we are, in some places we aren't. And where we aren't, we may see them be rising. When they've been leveled off, and I'm going to take Georgia for a minute because I spoke to the mayors of the two largest cities in Georgia, mayors of Atlanta and Augusta, over the weekend. And both of those mayors are deeply worried about a resurgence. And the modelers are telling us that if you reopen without testing and without appropriate case tracking, people are positive, you're going to get a big surge again. So that's a heavy responsibility for a governor to take. And I'm just urging extreme caution. And I'd rather have us figure out ways to adapt to these new rules, so to speak, than to put a lot of people, neighbors, friends, and our families in danger.
Dr. Erwin Redlener is the director of the Columbia University National Center for Disaster Preparedness. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Hope we can check in again with you soon, Doctor.
I wish you would. I'd be happy to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Up next, I don't know if you saw The Voice last night on NBC Channel 5 here in Cincinnati, but Michael Williams, the 18-year-old singer from Mason, he won a claim on that episode, and he's moving on. He'll be on the show again tonight, but first, we talk to him. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.